Every day in the mirror, she made me practice turning myself a different color. But it never worked, and Mother soon tired of me. But then she remembered how much she liked Ferenberries.
Oliver gasped.
And made me go hunting for them.
Alice looked away.
Gathering Ferenberries is the only thing I'm any good for.
But I thought Ferenberries were invisible, Oliver said, eyes wide. And then he whispered,
And I thought they weren't allowed under the Ferenwood Code of Permissible Food Things.
They're not really invisible,
Alice said, scrunching up her face.
They're just very good chameleons. They blend almost perfectly into any background, so they're hard to find.
She shrugged.
But all I had to do was find a single one, and I could change all of them to a color I could see, so I'd pick dozens at a time.
Oliver was visibly impressed.
And I didn't know they weren't allowed under the Ferenwood Code of Permissible Food Things,
Alice added nervously. Oliver was so stunned he had to stand. Well, he finally said, your mother sounds absolutely hideous. And then, forgive me, he said, clapping a hand over his mouth. I spoke out of turn. It's not my place to...
That's all right,
Alice said with a shaky smile.
Mother will be better when Father comes home. He always made her nicer. But I think I've disappointed Mother since even before Father left, perhaps in every way. And now,
she said quietly,
the only person who ever really loved me is trapped, hurting somewhere, lost in a world that wants to keep him forever, and I'd do anything to get him back, anything at all.
Alice touched the silk of her skirts.
You know,
she said quietly,
Father used to tell me I was beautiful.
Alice's eyes had filled with tears, so she knew it was time to stop. She stood as elegantly as she could, excused herself, and told Oliver she needed some air. He let her pass without a word. When Alice stepped outside, her hardships were easily forgotten. Here, in the land of Left, was more to enchant the eye than possibly anywhere else. The sun had begun its descent, and the sky had turned a dusty, smoky blue. Ambers and golds and violets melted along the horizon and kaleidoscoped through the branches, snowflaking spectacular shapes of light across the land. Everything was vivid green and richest brown, and the air was so full of freshness. One deep inhale, and her tears were zipped away, carefully stored for another day. Alice closed her eyes and let the breeze wash over her.
She was stronger than Mother.
And if she wasn't, she would be. She would be strong enough to fight for Father and not fall apart without him. He needed her to be smart, to stay alive, to keep fighting. Her love for Father made her brave. It made her better. It made her ready. More chapters straight ahead.
Is there anything you'd like to taste?
Paramint asked them. He'd popped his head into the egg house to see how they were doing. She and Oliver had been sitting together on the floor, making a list of all the things they'd do with Father when they finally brought him home. It was Oliver's idea to make the list. It was the first thing he'd said to her when she came back inside. He said that Father would want to know what had happened while he was gone, and since an awful lot had happened while he was gone, they should probably make a list. He'll want to see the new ponds and the fishing trees and, oh, we'll have to show him the boats that fell in Penelope's garden. We can't forget that. Oliver was already reaching for a sheaf of paper. Or how about the penny bushes near the brook? They're so big now. Don't you think he'd like to see that? Alice?
Alice was so touched she could hardly speak.
So there they sat, he and she, making plans for the day Father would come home, when suddenly Paramint was asking them whether there was anything they wanted to taste.
Taste?
Alice said, sitting up straighter.
What do you mean?
Well,
Paramint said, still standing at the door,
we have a very generous tasting menu at our disposal. Perhaps not as grand as you're accustomed,
he said, blushing.
But we do have a divine center-cut filet mignon that I'd humbly recommend for your tasting pleasure.
He bowed just a bit.
It was specially prepared for you by our resident chef, seasoned to perfection with rock salt and tea leaves, set on a bed of spiced couscous, and served with a side of truffled risotto. Though, of course, if that is not to your liking, we do have any number of sandwiches and roasts and hams to choose from.
Oh, my, she said, glancing at Oliver. I'm afraid I don't know what any of that is.
Paramount had frozen solid with full words still stuck in his mouth. To his great credit, he thawed rather quickly and said,
Is there something else I might offer you, your honorableness?
Alice thought for a moment and said,
Do you have any tulips?
We?
Paramount looked a little confused, but mostly he looked terrified of disappointing her, which made Alice feel awful.
Well, your honorableness, we do have a great many flowers, but none in bloom at this hour, I'm afraid.
Dear Paramount, said Oliver, please don't concern yourself with the flowers. Alice is only teasing you, he said, shooting her a swift look that said, Let me handle this. Perhaps we'll skip the main tasting this evening and go straight for the desserts, Oliver said. It's been a long journey, and something sweet sounds nice.
Oh, a fine idea, your honorableness.
Paramount was so excited he actually jumped in place.
A fine idea. I'll bring out a great selection of cakes and pies and muffins for you to feast on.
He was smiling with every bit of his face, so eager to do anything to make them happy.
Is there any other good thing I might do for you, your honorablenesses? Perhaps after you're done tasting, you'd like some time to dream?
This last bit caught Alice's attention, and she was nodding before she'd even asked for details.
That sounds wonderful, she said. I would dearly love to dream.
Very good, your honorableness, said Paramount, beaming. So very, very good. I shall return swiftly.
And with a bow and another smile, Paramount was gone. Alice immediately turned to Oliver, overcome with excitement.
I've missed dreaming so much. I dearly love dreaming, you know. It's my favorite part of sleeping.
Oliver laughed. I can't believe you're more excited about sleeping than you are about dessert.
Oh, said Alice, distracted. That reminds me, what is a filet mignon, exactly?
Oliver froze, his mouth caught open in a neat little O.
Nothing you need to worry about, he said hastily. Nothing at all.
Alice had never realized what a pleasure it could be to simply wake up in the morning. She and Oliver hadn't stayed in any town long enough to enjoy the luxury of sleeping or dreaming, and now, for the first time in what felt like a very, very long time, she blinked open bleary eyes and yawned her way into dawn, stretching one arm and two legs as far as they'd go. She was muddled and foggy and still a little dozy, but she was happier than she'd ever been in furthermore, and feeling ready to face the beginning of another endless day. Alice sprang to her feet and headed to Paramount's private toilets, which he'd said they might use, and splashed fresh water on her face, stopping to taste the few drops that fell on her lips.
Minty,
she thought. She'd dreamt all night long, topsy-turvy dreams no doubt inspired by her days in furthermore. She'd been running upside down, her feet stomping along the ceilings of homes she didn't recognize, chasing a man she thought to be father. The problem was, every time she got close enough, Oliver would pop out of a window and rip her arm off, and she'd lose track of father all over again. She'd had to remind herself 3 times already not to be angry with Oliver for being such a nuisance in her dreams, and just as she was reminding herself for the 4th time, she stepped out of the toilets to find him waiting for her.
"Good morning,"
she said with a smile.
"Good morning,"
said Oliver, but he looked awful, half asleep and a little sickly.
"Excuse me, Alice," he said, and nodded toward the toilets. "May I? I'm afraid I'm not feeling very well."
"Oh, Oliver,"
she said.
"Is there anything I can do?"
He made a weak effort to shake his head.
"I think I'll just rest here a while and hope the feeling passes."
He rubbed at his face. I vow I shall never eat a pie again, he said, and tried to laugh. Alice gave him a sympathetic look and nodded. While she'd taken only a few tastes, Oliver had tasted nearly half of everything Paramount brought them last night. She'd asked Oliver several times to take care, which is likely the only reason he hadn't devoured all 10 cakes, 7 pies, 15 muffins, and 4 puddings, and now she was glad to have guilted him so. She hadn't known Oliver had such a fondness for these decadent things, though he certainly seemed sorry for it this morning. She patted him on the shoulder and let him pass. While Oliver locked himself in the toilets, Alice tidied up the rest of the house. She hoped it would be their last day here, so she wanted to do good by Paramount and make sure they left his home just as nice as it was when they arrived. She rolled up the dreaming bags Paramount brought them. They were little sacks with pillows sewn all along the insides, very soft and cozy, and rearranged all his papers, careful to fold away the list they'd made for Father. She tucked the list into the pocket of her new silk gown, which for a gown had proven very comfortable, and then sat down on the pumpkin orange couch and waited for Paramount and Oliver. Except she soon tired of waiting and decided to step outside. It was a beautiful day, just as she'd expected. The sun had only barely begun to rise, and the land of Left was already in bloom. Its occupants scurried about, hanging freshly laundered clothes and buying freshly baked bread and stopping to chat with neighbors about one fascinating topic or another. The sight of it all made her miss home more than ever. "Good day to you, Your Honorableness." It was an eager and smiling Paramount who seemed surprised to find her up so early.
"Good day to you, too, Paramount," she said, smiling just as wide.
"Did you dream well?" he asked. "Did you enjoy the tasting?"
"Yes to both,"
she said happily. Then more quietly,
"Though I'm afraid Oliver may have tasted a bit too much."
Paramount's eyes went wide for just a moment before he laughed a hearty laugh.
"This is excellent news, Your Honorableness. I'm thrilled to hear he enjoyed himself."
Alice didn't have the heart to tell him that Oliver's enjoyment was short-lived.
"He certainly did," she said. "Thank you again."
"You're quite welcome."
Paramount was bouncing up and down on his toes, bursting with excitement.
"Well, I can't keep it in any longer, Your Honorableness. Keep what? We have great news, Your Honorableness. Great news!"
"Oh?"
"Yes, indeed. Today will be the most excellent day, Your Honorableness. Last night we had the most exciting evening, and today we've had the most exciting morning. Such incredible news!"
"How lovely,"
Alice said politely. She couldn't articulate why, exactly, but Paramount's eagerness was making her uncomfortable.
"I do hope good things are in store for the Land of Left."
"They are. The best things. The very best things."
"Well, that's very nice. I better get back to you,"
Paramount said, wagging a finger at her.
"You have done a very bad thing, Your Honorableness, a very, very bad thing, but your bad thing has been the best news for the Land of Left, the best news."
Alice swallowed hard, forcing herself to speak, even with the surge of panic seizing her body.
"I'm not sure I know what you're talking about,"
she managed to say. Paramount laughed and laughed.
"You've broken the law. You've stolen time. Hours and hours you've stolen. We were notified just last night that we had a criminal in our midst."
He beamed.
"The Land of Left. Can you believe it? Our visitor, a criminal. Oh, you've made us famous, Your Honorableness. We've not been contacted by the elders for 56 years,
he said,
"and now here we are with a visitor who brings attention to our land. What a day! What a day!"
"Is that what you're happy about?"
Alice nearly collapsed with relief.
"Well,"
she said meekly,
"I'm certainly glad to be of service."
Paramount lowered his voice and leaned in.
"Now we are going to do our best.
to keep the elders from arresting you, but we can't hold them off for long. We'll have to be quick about things. So come with me. Come with me. Lots to do.
Alice refused to move.
What do you mean? Where are we going?
To prepare the feast, of course, cried Paramount. We wouldn't normally plan the feast until the end of your stay, he said in a low voice. But now that we know you've broken the law, there's no reason to wait. Besides, your getting arrested will only complicate matters, he said, waving a hand. But if we take care of things before the authorities arrive, everyone will be so pleased. The queens haven't had a full meal in far too long, and you and your friend are sure to satisfy a large appetite. The twin sisters will be thrilled.
Alice stood frozen, sick with fright, and nodded as best she could before Paramount. Kindly old Paramount darted away, expecting her to follow. Alice's skin was clammy with cold sweat and sudden, horrible, slithering fear, and she could feel her throat beginning to close. Why she had ever allowed herself to feel safe in Furthermore she did not know, but now she knew there was only one thing left to do. Run! Alice flew back into the room as fast as she could, heart beating hard, hoping she could get to Oliver and out the door before Paramount ever came back. She pounded on the toilet door, shouting Oliver's name several times, but there was no answer. She had no choice but to break a very important rule in Furthermore and open the door without permission. Thank heavens she did. Oliver was lying on the floor, half-conscious, mostly limp, and extremely heavy. He looked half-dead already. Suddenly her talk with Paramount put everything in perspective. This was no matter of overindulgence. Paramount had tried to poison them in preparation for the impending feast. He wanted them weak and pliant. He wanted them drugged, and it took every bit of strength she had to keep from panicking. Instead, she slapped Oliver in the face. He blinked his eyes open.
"Oliver," she said, still trying, and failing, not to panic. "Oliver, please, please wake up, please wake up."
"I'm sorry, Alice," he said, breathing hard. "I'm afraid I'm not."
He swallowed.
"Not feeling very well."
"Yes, yes, I know, dear friend, but you must get to your feet," she said. "Please, please try to get to your feet, because we need to go. We must leave right this instant."
"What?"
Oliver blinked at her again.
"Why, Alice, what's the matter?"
Alice hesitated, terrified, then said,
"They want to eat us."
Oliver's eyes flew open. He knew better than to waste time asking why. Maybe at another time, in a different state of mind, Oliver might have been able to persuade them out of this, but he was painfully sick, and not himself, and she knew she couldn't ask him to save their lives. For the second time, she had to save him. And somehow, even now, during one of the most terrifying moments of her life, she felt a rush of true affection for Oliver, because she knew he'd decided right then to put his life in her hands and to follow her lead.
"Let's go,"
he said, and in an act of great determination, he pulled himself to his feet. Alice slung his bag over his shoulder, his heavy arm over her shoulder, and allowed Oliver to lean against her much smaller frame, and though at any other time this might have seemed impossible, their weights didn't matter now. They were both adrenaline from head to foot and moving on instinct. Still, Alice felt like it took forever to reach the front door. In her mind, their every slow movement brought Paramount closer, and every sudden sound meant Paramount was around the corner, waiting to pounce. In fact, Alice was so focused on outrunning Paramount that it hadn't even occurred to her where they'd go to outrun him. Not until they reached the door and Oliver said,
"Where now, Alice?"
But she didn't know. She was in a real panic. She looked left, looked right. They were surrounded on all sides by the busy bodies making up the land of left, and there was no other place to go, no other person to trust. Eggshell homes had been strung from nearly every branch as far as she could see, and there was no doubt in her mind that if they tried to hide here, they would too easily be found. For a moment, Alice even considered turning everything black again. After all, it had worked on the foxes, but they were not on flat land, which made everything more dangerous. Alice and Oliver would be running across a series of treetops, It would be too dangerous to run blindly. One misstep and they'd plummet to their deaths. But maybe...
maybe they stayed put. Maybe they stayed here and bided their time, played nice with Paramount until they formed a real plan, until Oliver was feeling better and could persuade them to have someone else for dinner. Maybe they'd be able to think more clearly in a couple of hours. After all, Paramount wanted to plan a feast. They wouldn't be eaten in the next 5 minutes. Maybe Alice had gotten ahead of herself. She was too anxious and panicked. She was sure that was it. In fact, now she was sure they would do better to stay. Racing around with no rational plan couldn't help them at all, she thought. So she exhaled a deep breath and glanced back at the eggshell home, ready to tell Oliver her new idea. Except that when she glanced back, there stood Paramount, hovering just to the side of his own front door, smiling at her in a way that she no longer trusted. He carried in one hand a very large linen sack, and in the other, a very large butcher knife. Something inside of Alice screamed, but she didn't say a word. Paramount's eyes were locked onto hers, and when he next spoke, his voice was suddenly too high, too happy, all wrong.
"Where are you going, your honorableness?"
At any other time, they might have been able to dash past Paramount and head back from whence they came, but Oliver could barely stand, much less sprint. Alice scanned the forest floor for options and found little solace in the 1,000-foot fall below them. Oliver had said that falling in furthermore was too anticlimactic to be deadly, but Alice felt certain that this drop would be an exception. After all, if it were safe to fall so far, why was the seamstress pushed off the branch? All these thoughts rushed through Alice's mind in only a snip of a second, but this last question reminded Alice of something she'd nearly forgotten. It was something Ancilly had said, something she sang.
"I fell into the sky one day, and it didn't hurt at all. I fell into the sky one day, but I didn't fall at all." Was it possible? Was Ancilly trying to tell her how to escape?
Well, Alice had no idea, but trusting Ancilly was her only option at the moment, as Paramount was still holding a butcher knife within slicing distance. Alice was out of options and fully tapped of time, but she'd not yet lost her hope. So she took a deep breath and whispered,
"Fall, Oliver, fall."
And they did. She and Oliver clung to each other as they fell, and in her mind Alice was already apologizing to him for being the reason he died. Alice was half hope, half horror, split vertically down the middle about her chances at survival. She wanted to believe there was merit to Ancilly's song, but how could she? She was currently plummeting to her death. Worse still, this didn't feel anything like flying. This felt like dying. Though at least this death, Alice thought, would be a less brutal one. Alice had no interest in being eaten. So there they were, falling to their deaths. Neither one of them screamed, as it seemed to serve no purpose. And all Alice saw were Oliver's eyes, wide and scared and sad. So she closed her own, wrapped her single arm more tightly around his, and prayed for a quick, relatively painless exit from these worlds. But no matter how dramatic they tried to make the moment, muscles tensed, whispering quiet goodbyes to the ones they loved, their imminent demise was running a bit late. Eventually Alice opened her eyes and found that Oliver had too. They were indeed still falling, and there was indeed a ground coming up beneath them, but something strange was happening, too. The farther they fell, the slower the fall, and soon they weren't rushing to the ground at all, but floating, floating, gently and steadily all the way down. They landed on the forest floor with their feet flat on the ground. She and Oliver were so surprised to still be alive that they spent the first few moments just staring at each other.
"Are you all right?"
Alice finally said. Oliver was standing on his own now, and he looked wide awake.
"Are you feeling okay?"
Oliver nodded. "I think that just scared the sick out of me."
"Well, thank heavens for small presents,"
Alice said, now feeling weak in the knees. She sank to the ground. "You don't think they'll jump after us, do you?" said Oliver. Alice looked up, startled.
"I don't..."
"They might," said a voice she didn't recognize. Alice jumped straight up and back and hit her head against Oliver's chest. His heart was beating as hard as hers. He steadied her shoulder against him, and they both looked toward the stranger. The voice had come from a woman, the likes of which Alice had never seen before. Except, perhaps, in a mirror. She was pale as moonlight and exceptionally tall, and she wore a cloak made entirely of golden leaves, vibrant yellow, dingy mustard, lemon and honey and saffron and sunlight. The leaves layered together looked like a collection of slivered wings, creating the illusion of something both monstrous and beautiful all at once. The lengths of the stranger's robes dragged beneath her, swallowing up her arms and legs. Only her hands, paler even than Alice's, could still be seen. The hood of her cloak, also created from leaves, did not mask her face. She wore her hood only halfway, and the long, impossibly yellow locks of her hair, nearly indistinguishable from her hood, fell to her shoulders, and her face, ghostly white, was lit only by a pair of matching golden eyes. "They might," she said again, "so you'd do best to come with me." There was something terrifying about her, glowing and beautiful and looming over them, but there was something else about her, too, something in her eyes. This woman had felt true pain before, and somehow Alice knew this was true. Again Alice thought of Ancilly. Ancilly, whose song had saved their life. "I saw a lady reach for me. She told me not to fear. I saw a lady speak to me. She told me help was here." "Who are you?" Alice finally managed to ask. "I am Isal," she said. She did not blink. "Would you like to die?"
"No," Oliver said quickly. Alice could hear his heart quicken. "Of course we wouldn't."
"Then come with me," she said, and turned away. As she walked, she left a trail of golden leaves behind, like a snail that could not help but make a map of its travels. But Isal was no snail, that much was obvious, and Alice envied her steady, quiet strength. She wanted to follow her. And, anyway, they had no other choices. She and Oliver marched along behind her, sending each other sideways glances that did little more than remind them that they were not alone. They followed Isal deep, deep into the maze of the woods. But walking wasn't without its challenges. The forest floor was zigzagged by giant trunks of gigantic trees, the tops of which made up the land of Left. The roots that covered the forest floor were monstrously large. They were among the widest and tallest Alice would ever see. These trunks were thicker than most homes. As she and Oliver did their best to scramble over the mountain-sized roots, Alice was suddenly grateful for Isal's colorful cloak. Without it, they'd have lost her long ago. Finally, they reached a small clearing where a dilapidated cottage had been shoved unceremoniously against a tree trunk wider than the cottage itself. The home was simply made, the exterior whitewashed, a dull shade. There were two windows cut into a wall not obscured by the tree, but the glass looked dingy and yellow, like the ancient windows had never seen a breeze. Tall, wild grass grew up the sides of the house, and the roof looked like it had collapsed a bit, right in the middle, and Alice could see why. 5 forever green trees had planted themselves on top of the cottage, nearly suffocating the slanted brick chimney, while haphazardly grown tufts of grass and roots gripped the roof in a proprietary fist. This home seemed to have been planted here. It was as if it had grown in and within the forest itself. Isal opened the front door and turned to face them. "You may come inside." But Alice and Oliver hesitated.
"Who are you?" Oliver said.
Isal stepped forward. "I am Isal," she said.
"Yes, but that doesn't help us at all, does it?" said Oliver.
Isal looked confused. "Your companion is wearing my designs," she said to him. "And yet you do not know who I am?"
"The seamstress,"
Alice whispered. Esau nodded at Alice.
Yes,
she said before looking away. There was a stroke of sadness in her eyes.
I was the seamstress. I am not any more.
Alice was too struck to speak. There was so much to be afraid of, so much to be concerned about in that moment, but Alice couldn't help but be awed by the woman standing before her. Esau, even in her loneliness, even in her sadness, was entirely too elegant to be real. She was everything Alice had ever hoped to be, strong, brave, dignified, and yet Esau was here, a gem buried in the forest, an outcast. Alice felt a kind of kinship with this stranger, and she couldn't find the words to explain why. Esau stepped forward and touched the feathers on Alice's dress.
I remember this gown,
she said softly.
It took me 2 years to collect enough feather lilies to finish the collar.
She dropped her hand.
Anne Silly sent word that you were coming.
She sent word? Alice said. But
she was my apprentice many years ago,
Esau said.
Long before I was pushed off the branch.
So they really pushed you off the branch? Oliver said, aghast. Why?
Esau finally blinked. 56 years ago,
she said,
when we'd had our last visitor, a young girl not much older than you,
she said to Alice.
I tried to warn her away. I knew that ultimately she would be sacrificed for the queens.
Esau looked away.
I did not agree with the queen's methods, and my actions were not appreciated. I was considered a traitor and pushed off the branch.
Alice's eyes went impossibly wide. So they thought you would die, Oliver said. Esau nodded.
But there is great magic at the bottom of the trees, and it does not wish to do harm. I have been safe here.
Do they know? Oliver asked, gesturing to the sky, to the land of left. Do they know it's safe down here?
They suspect it might be, she said. But they do not know for certain, so we must hurry. We do not know if they will come looking for you. Please,
she said,
come inside. I can help you.
But you say you've been here all this time,
Alice said nervously.
And yet you've never been discovered. How can we trust that your story is true? What if you're working with everyone else? What if we step inside your house only to be stuffed in an oven?
Esau smiled a strange, sad smile and pulled back her hood. Her golden hair, no longer framed by the yellow of her cloak, was dimmer now, desaturated. She looked almost as white as Alice did, pale on pale, all color sapped from her skin. And when she spoke only to Oliver.
Perhaps you should trust a friend who looks like one.
Oliver couldn't shake off his shock. How did you know? He said. How did you know my Tibbon?
Esau considered him carefully. Furthermore is only occasionally as helpful as it pretends to be.
She said,
all Tibbons are created purposely, in conjunction with furthermore citizens, and in accordance with the happenstance of your path through this land. The moment you arrived, your future was measured, hypotheses were made, and I was sent notification of my role in your journey. Now that you're here, I'm tasked with providing you one piece of advice that will aid you in the rest of your excursion. Once the help is received, my bit is done.
Alice and Oliver were stunned.
We are never allowed to speak of our roles in all this,
Esau said.
But as I gave up on my loyalty to furthermore long ago, I don't see the harm in telling you. But to deny a Tibbon is a moral offense, not a legal one, and so I am honor-bound to assist you.
She bowed her head forward an inch and let her eyes rest on Alice's and Oliver's slack-jawed expressions.
No one has ever found me, you know.
Yes, Oliver said and looked around. I can imagine.
No, said Esau. You don't understand. A Tibbon pinned to me is most ungenerous. Left is a land long forgotten, and I, Esau, am the most unremembered of them all.
She paused, studying the two of them carefully.
Assigning a Tibbon to me means the elders were never trying to help you. In fact, it's likely they expected you to fail many moves ago. That you were clever enough to find me means that you are close to achieving what you desire. But tread carefully. The elders cannot be happy about this.
Alice and Oliver swallowed their fear and said nothing.
No,
said Esau, and clasped her hands.
I have more than answered all your questions, so I must insist, for the final time, that you come inside. If you stand here a moment longer, I will not be responsible for your deaths.
Alice and Oliver stumbled after Esau into her humble home, hearts racing in unison. Furthermore was meaner and twistier than even Oliver had imagined. They knew for certain now that their every move had been mapped and choreographed. The odds had been deliberately stacked against them. Their combined talents had kept them alive just long enough to move from one village to another, but the longer they stayed in Furthermore, the faster their luck would run out, and they would have to be sharper than ever if they were to have any hope of surviving the rest of their journey. They were now fugitives on the run, and both Tibbons had been spent. Alice was shaken back to the present as she walked into the organized chaos of Esau's home. Her cottage was little more than a glorified storage box. Every inch of wall space was covered in ornately framed oil paintings.
All my things were saved and pushed off the branch by dear Anne Silly,
she'd said, while the interior square footage was set aside for her sewing supplies. Pins and needles and spools of thread and endless bolts of luscious fabrics were stacked up to the ceiling. Dress forms, boxes of jewels and baskets of feathers were arranged in tidy rows. Her home was small, but it was colorful and clean, and once they'd stepped fully inside, Esau removed her cape. Esau managed to be beautiful in entirely her own way. She wore soft blue silks that draped around and across her body, and they made her look like a barely remembered dream, blurred at the edges and impossible to grasp. It was the first time Alice had ever thought a pale person could be beautiful, and it gave her great hope. Esau was not like Alice, not entirely, for she had depths of gold, even in her paleness, but even so she looked very different from everyone back home in Farrenwood.
So, Esau said abruptly, you are looking for a painter.
Yes, Oliver said, startled. How did you know?
Esau narrowed her eyes at Oliver like he might be a bit bent in the head. Your friend is missing an arm?
Right, he said quickly. Right, of course.
And you are certain, Esau said, that this is the one piece of information you seek? There is no greater question you'd care to ask.
Alice's heart kicked into gear. She looked frantically at Oliver. Would this be their only chance to ask for help? Shouldn't they use it to ask about father?
Oliver,
she said,
don't you think—'
"'This is not your decision,' Esau said swiftly. She gave Alice a look that was not exactly unkind, but a bit cold.
It's not your Tibbon to interfere.
But I'm certain, Oliver said firmly. We need to get her arm fixed.
Oliver, please.
We can still do both, he said to her, taking her only hand.
I promise, Alice, we'll find a way, even if we have to start all over again. But before we do anything else, you're getting your arm back.
Alice swallowed hard. She was nearly in tears.
Very good, Esau said. Your solution is simple. Pick any painting,
she gestured to her walls,
and step inside.
Oliver's eyebrows shot up. That's all? Esau nodded. Alice and Oliver looked at each other, faces breaking into smiles, relief flooding through their veins.
All right, Oliver said, grinning up to his ears. He looked over the paintings. How about, oh, I don't know, how's this one?
He said to Alice. Isal stepped in front of him.
Choose wisely, she said. If the painter refuses to let you enter his home, you will remain here, she said, touching the canvas. In the painting of your choosing.
What? Said Oliver.
For how long? Said Alice.
Forever, Isal said. Sudden horror buckled Alice's knees.
What do you mean? Oliver demanded. What nonsense is this? Why didn't you tell us there was a catch before you gave us our answer? You said the solution was simple, he said, his neck going red with anger.
It is not my job to protect you from the consequences of your own questions, Isal said unkindly. You wanted to know how to find a painter. I told you how to find one. My duty is done.
But suddenly the ground groaned and the walls shook. Just outside the window a storm of yellow leaves had thrown itself against the glass. Alice knew instantly that it was a sign. Those were the leaves Isal had left behind, and now they'd come to find her.
They're here,
Isal said softly, staring at nothing as she spoke. And in the time it took Alice and Oliver to catch their breath, there were four knocks at the door, one for every set of knuckles, which meant four people were waiting outside. Alice knew they wouldn't be polite for very long. Isal grabbed her cloak.
Choose wisely, she whispered. Choose wisely, and good luck.
Oliver met Alice's eyes in a sudden panic, and she knew there was no time to deliberate. She took Oliver's hand, scanned the frames for a scene that reminded her most of home and love and father, and pushed their clasped hands through the painting. It really was that simple. Their bodies were sucked through by a force Alice could not name, and soon they were pulled and pushed through a tightness that squeezed their chests until she was sure they would burst, and when Alice next opened her eyes, she and Oliver were standing in what looked like an ancient prison cell. It smelled like mold and rust, the ceiling so low Oliver was forced to stoop. The two of them didn't even have a chance to panic before a slim panel in the wall was forced open, letting a slice of light slip through. Alice squinted against the brightness.
"What's your business?"
a voice barked at them. It sounded distinctly male, but there was no way to be certain.
"I've come to fix my arm," said Alice nervously. "I heard you were a
"Which arm is it?" the stranger snapped.
"My right."
The man grunted but said no more.
"Please," she said. "Please help us."
The panel slammed shut. Alice was nearly in tears with worry. This was their last chance, and she didn't know what they'd do if the painter didn't allow them clearance to pass. And no sooner had she begun to wonder whether the painter wouldn't simply leave them in that cell to die, when one of the cell walls swung open, and she and Oliver were ejected unceremoniously into a foot of fresh snow. Once she shook the snow out of her eyes, Alice tried to take in their surroundings. But no matter how many times she blinked, she couldn't get the colors to come into focus. The trouble was, there were no colors here at all. It was like a scene clipped from a newspaper and made whole unto itself. They were in the middle of an eerily flat, snowy landscape, not a single tree in sight, and every shade and shadow was a variation on white and black. Compared to this world, Alice was practically neon, and her whiteness seemed suddenly nuanced, layered, its own kind of color. Where she and Oliver felt real and full of life, everything in this world looked drab and dim and, frankly, a little dead. It was as though all color had been snuffed out, sapped of life, and in its place were gray skies, gray wind, gray cold. Before them and beyond them was absolutely nothing, save one single solitary structure, a giant half-globe made entirely of gray glass. Its contents were spare but visually arresting, The pops of black that made up the furniture contrasted starkly against the very white snow, making for a stunning, simple presentation of beauty and contrasts. More romantic still, it was snowing. Confetti flakes fell from the sky, piling up all around them and frosting the top of the gray glass globe. It looked like a lost ornament, fallen and frozen in the snow of a holiday season. The more Alice looked at this black-and-white scene, the more she began to appreciate the subtleties of light and shadow, and though Alice eventually found it quite lovely, it was also entirely foreign to her. They were not in the painting she'd chosen. The painting she'd chosen had been rich in autumnal colors, which had to mean that they'd not been refused access to the painter. They'd not been refused. Oh, the shock of it! Alice thought she might scream. So she did just that. She fell back in the snow, and she shouted for joy, and she grabbed Oliver's arm and said, "This isn't the painting I picked. This isn't the one. The one I picked was in a meadow when it was autumn, and there were leaves on the ground, and there were little homes everywhere, and oh, Oliver," she said, "we made it!" Oliver sat down beside her, looking solemn but kind, and wrapped his arm around her shoulders. "Yes," he said softly, "I dare say we have." They hugged, he and she, for a very long time, just clinging to each other, happy to be alive, grateful to have survived yet another stage of furthermore. It was starting to wear on them now, nearly dying all the time. Alice promised herself that if they made it back to Ferinwood, she would never again complain about a lack of adventure. She would be perfectly happy with a walk to the town square and a peek at the boats in Penelope's garden. She tried to convince herself that it would be enough for her, that she could be happy with a simple, safe life tethered to Ferinwood, but even now, at the tail end of a crisis, she couldn't quite manage it, because she knew that wasn't true. She wanted to go home, yes, and she wanted to spend more time with Father, and she wanted to eat tulips and sit by the pond, but even after all the trials and tribulations of furthermore, or perhaps because of them, she didn't think she could ever go back to an ordinary life. She knew she'd never say no to adventure. Alice broke away from Oliver and beamed at him. "Don't just park your hindquarters in the snow," someone barked at them. "Good grief, girl, you'll catch your death out there." Alice and Oliver looked up to discover a man scowling at them. He looked human enough, but the distance between his world and theirs seemed infinite. She realized then that a man in black and white seems impossibly gray, and even more impossible to reach. It was almost as though he existed in a different dimension. Something was nagging at the back of Alice's mind. A bit of conversation. Something Tim had told her. "Hey, I'm talking to you," the man shouted again, and Alice sprang to attention. The man was brandishing a cane at the two of them. Alice noticed that he had a scruffy black beard and wore a wool cap that pushed down over his eyes, and between his lips was an unlit pipe, and as he talked it bobbed around in his mouth. "Sitting in the snow in a silk gown," he grumbled. "Up, the lot of you," he said, poking Oliver with his cane. "Get inside." She and Oliver stumbled to their feet and stared at the man.
"Are you?"
she started to say. "Of course I am," he said. "Do you see anyone else here? Now hurry up," he said. "I've put the kettle on and it'll be whistling by now." They did as they were told and followed the old man toward the half-globe home. The man stopped short a few feet and then began to disappear from his ankles up. It was only as she got closer that Alice realized he was walking down a set of stairs. They quickly followed his lead. It was him, then her, then Oliver, disappearing into the ground only to then climb their way back up. Except when they finally faced a door, it opened from overhead. Alice stomped the snow off her feet as they climbed, and as they crossed the threshold up and into the glass home, she did her best not to trail any dirt or wet onto the old man's floor. Suddenly she and Oliver were standing in the middle of a clear dome and looking out at the snowy world from the comfort of a toasty, cozy sanctuary. As promised, the kettle had already begun to whistle. The old man moved quickly and easily for someone who carried a cane, and she wondered for a moment why he carried it. She noticed then that there was no real kitchen, no living room or bedroom, but one big space where everything sat out in the open. There were no secrets here, no closed doors, no walls or windows. All the furniture was minimal and spare. Clean lines and simple frames, black seat cushions, gray pillows, and a threadbare blanket that was neatly folded and placed atop a bed. Solid shades of gray dotted her vision. This home was a place where colors did not exist and patterns were not made. It was steady, sturdy, and extremely tidy. The rug underfoot was soft and gray and fluffy, and not bothered by a single spot. Alice and Oliver weren't sure what to do with themselves. It was a strange home for a painter, stranger still that there was no sign of his paintings anywhere. Alice cleared her throat, rocked back and forth on the balls of her feet, and waited for the old man to return. He came forward with fast, heavy footfalls, now moving without the assistance of his cane, holding two cups of hot tea that spilled into their saucers with his every step, and set them down on a small table around which a large couch and a few chairs had gathered. No cream, no sugar, no please or thank you. "Well, sit down, then," said the man, looking from her to Oliver, obviously irritated. He pulled the wool cap off his head to reveal a rather large tuft of dark hair that stuck straight up before falling into his face, and as she and Oliver tentatively took their seats, so did he. He seemed much younger than Alice had originally thought he was. In fact, she was fairly certain he wasn't old at all. He was just crabby. She tried to get a better look at his face, but he ducked his chin into his chest, and his eyes were now partially obscured by his hair. Alice sat back, confused. It was coming back to her now, her conversations with Tim, and she looked around, carefully cataloging all the gray. There was not a spot of bright color anywhere, and Alice was growing more convinced by the moment. This must be a prison village. But how could it be? Could the painter also be an inmate? Alice wasn't sure. She didn't know furthermore well enough to know whether this was possible. Alice looked to Oliver and nearly told him what she was thinking. She was thinking that if this was a prison village, that perhaps this man might be able to tell her how to find Father. But fear had made her too afraid to hope, so she kept her theories to herself. Oliver cleared his throat. The painter crossed his legs and leaned back in his chair. She noticed then that he wore thick wool socks, and leveled them with a stare she couldn't quite match. Alice felt too open, too vulnerable and bright-eyed, so she looked away. "So you've come about your arm, then," he said to her. Alice nodded. "And how did you manage to lose it?" he said. She blinked up at him, then looked down again, frowning.
I made a mistake," she said,
digging the toe of her shoe into the carpet.
"What kind of mistake?" he said.
"I followed a paper fox," Alice said quietly. "My right arm turned to paper." She hesitated. "And then the fox ripped my arm off."
Alice didn't know why she was speaking so stiltedly, or, more importantly, she didn't know why the painter made her so nervous, but her hand was sweating and her heart was pounding and her emotions were trying to tell her something she couldn't yet hear. The painter laughed a loud, humorless laugh.
"You followed a paper fox and got your arm ripped off," he sighed. "Yep, sounds about right."
His voice was rough from lack of use, but there was something about it that made Alice feel like she was overheating, something in it, somewhere in the rustiness that reminded her of something, of someone she could not place.
"What's your name?"
he said, tilting his head, and for just a moment, his hair shifted out of his eyes. Alice thought she might collapse.
"Oliver," she cried. "Oliver."
"Your name is Oliver? That's a strange name for a girl."
"My name is Oliver," said Oliver, who jumped up and was now looking anxiously at Alice. "What's wrong?" he said to her. "What's the matter?" But Alice couldn't get the words out. She was seeing spots. She thought her throat might close up.
"Alice,"
said Oliver, panicking. "Alice, what are you—"
"Her name is Alice,"
said the painter, who was now on his feet.
"Father,"
she gasped.
"Father."
And then she fainted.
Oh, my goodness! I don't know how much time elapsed between when she fell and when she woke. Oliver says it was at least several minutes, but when Alice finally blinked open her eyes, they'd already filled to the brim with tears. Alice, Alexis Queensmeadow, had finally found Father. Accidentally, unintentionally, serendipitously, Alice had found Father, and she was unsinkably happy. Their reunion was long and joyous. Tears were shed, laughter was shared, stories were recounted from all. Alice's and Oliver's stories are already familiar to you, so I won't bother relating them again, but Father's story was new, and certainly new to you, too, so I'll do my best to remember exactly what was said. However, before I do, I'd like to address one detail that must be bothering you. Strange, you must think, that Father hadn't recognized Alice himself. You are wise to wonder so. And when Alice first told me how it all happened, I thought it strange, too. But we must remember that Father had been locked away for 3 Ferenwood years in the heart of an impossible land. Father had never dreamed, never dared to think it possible that his young daughter would, firstly, know a single thing about Furthermore, and, secondly, have survived long enough to find him when he, a grown man, had barely survived himself. He had never dreamed Alice might show up. In fact, when Father saw Alice and Oliver requesting permission to enter his village, he accepted their request solely because the young girl he saw, her white hair, her white skin, reminded him a great deal of his own daughter. Alice, too, had no idea how much she'd changed since the last time she'd seen him. The girl who sat in front of Father now was a girl greatly changed from the 9-year-old Father remembered. This new Alice was confident and bold. She was articulate and passionate. She had become the kind of person who'd lived through hardship and survived with grace. Father hardly recognized her, though it took very little encouragement for him to be reminded. Now, let us return to their reunion. As you might imagine, Alice and Oliver had thousands of questions for Father. What happened after he arrived in Furthermore? Why had he come? Why hadn't he told anyone? What happened to get him stuck? Was he really a spy? And so forth. But as their conversations were exhaustive, rerouted by endless tangents and punctuated by waves of tears and silent embraces, I will, in the interest of expediency, make an effort to summarize all that was said in a short set of paragraphs. Father had indeed been arrested for wasting time, and enslaved imprisonment was indeed his punishment. He was sentenced to the prison village of Ink, which was where he'd been isolated ever since. It was a comfortable setup. He had his own home, and he wasn't wearing shackles. But what was life without color? No friends, no family, not even a cellmate, not a single thing to read. Father had been desperately depressed and lonely. He'd grown gruff and angry, and his bitterness made him reject nearly every job request he'd received. Being a painter, you see, was his enslavement. He was forced to do labor for Furthermore as a means of penance, and in this case, it was painting new limbs for those who'd lost them. Occasionally, Father would paint someone a leg instead of an arm, or a finger instead of a toe, just to keep things interesting, but mostly it was a tedium of the same boring work. "You'd be surprised," he said, "how many people lose limbs in Furthermore." But Father's greater story began many moons back, beginning with his own surrender and with the task he'd been tasked by the Ferenwood elders. Father, as you know, had been sent to map the many magical lands, and after having lived and survived in Furthermore so long, he thought he'd have no trouble surviving again. "What I didn't realize," he said, "was that my brain was different when I was younger. I was successful because my mind was nimble and my ideas about the world were flexible. The tricks and twists of Furthermore were easier to navigate." He sighed. "But as I got older, I became more set in my ways. It was harder to think differently, and it took me longer to figure everything out. I had so much more to lose this time around, and the fear crippled me. I was too nervous, too careful. I made too many mistakes." He shook his head. "I never should have come back. I wouldn't have dared if I didn't think it would be worth it." Oliver, you see, had been right about why Father returned to Furthermore. He was no spy for Ferenwood.
His effort was entirely for Alice, always for Alice. This, dear listener, was the most difficult conversation for the group of them to get through because there was so much emotion to contend with. Alice was devastated to have been the reason Father had put himself in danger. After all, Father